Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller. Really great to have you listening in today as we talk about the vegetable garden with the Vicars of Vegetables, Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman, professors of horticulture at UW-Madison. It's been a long time since they've been with us, so it's great to have them back. And certainly, I hope you will join in with your questions and comments and maybe haikus. Every time they are with us, pretty much every time, Jim at least has a haiku. He's got one with us for us today. You may have a haiku that you want to give us about a vegetable in your garden, or maybe you just have a question about what's going on in your garden. Are things going well in your garden? Not so well? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question, a comment, or a photo. If you got a great photo of your garden, love to have that as well.
How does that work on radio?
How does it work out? Well, that's because we've got our Facebook page, Jim.
Okay.
Thanks for coming, by the way.
Thank you, sir.
And Erwin, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having us back, Larry.
You know, and I have been hearing some rumors about tempura squash blossoms and how they have made their way. Erwin, you want to?
Jim is a, you know, for those of you listeners who don't know Jim personally, he's a culinary genius. And he has, I think, perfected one of the finest vegetable dishes known to humankind. And that is the tempura squash blossom. I mean, it defines elegance. It is a thing of fantastic beauty, Jim. So I think he's making it for not only for our students, but he's now making it for the neighbors.
The entire neighborhood, they are just enthralled with the with the tempura squash flower, and and my batter includes one of Wisconsin's most important foods, which is beer.
Ah.
And so that's part of the batter. Do you soak them in beer? How do you do that?
No. You have to prepare the batter itself. You have to let it sit for several hours, and you don't want to beat the flour. There's a lot of techniques involved in this. Mm-hmm. And then you simply harvest the flowers in the early morning.
Mm-hmm. What stage do you want to get them?
I harvest open flowers because they tend to be sweet. The closed flowers tend to have higher levels of the cucurbitacin.
Yeah. Mm.
So you want to I harvest open flowers, you dip them, and they will sort of close up, and they're very sweet. And
so you dip them, and then you throw them in hot oil? Or?
Yes, sir, we do indeed, because that is the Wisconsin tradition. Beer and hot oil are pretty much my two major food groups.
And they're good. And they're,
well, I would have to
Erwin,
say that.
Erwin, would you attest to this?
It's just elegant. It's beautiful, really. And the thing about the squash blossom, though, is that occasionally you will find a striped and spotted cucumber beetle in the flower. Mm. And when you cook up one of those in with the blossom, it's
another one of those little surprises.
You've had
the incident. Well, I advised one of my students was having some, let's say, some dating issues. And I said to him, I said, look, not only do I provide exquisite academic advice, but I also can go beyond that and provide, you know, relationship advice as well. I said, here's the deal. I said, chilled Chardonnay and a little bucket of tempura squash flowers and a little picnic. He prepares the whole deal according to my instructions. Unfortunately, he did not look carefully inside the squash flowers, and they had some of the striped cucumber beetle. Mm-hmm. The striped cucumber beetles are attracted to squash because they sequester that compound. That's just why no birds will eat them, right? Yeah. Because they're bitter.
They're really bitter.
They're super bitter.
Yeah.
Well, the young lady in question was just, you know, totally enamored until she bit into the
tempura squash flower.
And then that bitterness, there was a bitterness not only to the flavor, but to the relationship.
Yeah, there's a message there.
There is a message there.
Yeah,
Well, we have an email from Barb who actually was on our England trip, and I had five Barbaras with us on our trip to England, so I'm not sure which Barbara this is.
We weren't invited.
But yeah, she says our vegetable garden pretty much dried up during the hot dry spell. What vegetables, if any, can be planted and harvested now and still get them before the frost?
Well, you have to have... Gardening is not only an exercise in applied ecology, it's also an exercise in faith.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have faith that indeed we will be blessed with rainfall. And mm-hmm. therefore, there are an array of fall vegetables. I mean, certainly, you know, the brassicas, the spinaches,
sure.
the radishes.
Sure.
I mean, I know that the price for your faith in that things may change is the cost of those seeds. What do you think, Ruben?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, some of the traditional spring planted vegetables make an even better fall crop. You know, and I'm thinking, as Jim said, the brassicas, the broccolis and whatnot will do beautifully. But even a crop like beets, which is one of my favorites, the fall planted beets are more colorful and more sweet than the spring planted
ones. How late can you plant a beet?
I've planted as late as late July.
Really?
And you can harvest in October.
Ruben, after this show, I'm going to go plant my beets based on this advice.
They are just fantastic in the fall. I know Jim is not a fan of this next one, but I will say kale that does well. But, you know, many of those brassicas will be excellent now.
I agree with you, though, although I think if you want an indication that your CSA is in trouble, it's when they're sending out recipes for kale.
But Vickers of Vegetables with us today to talk about your vegetable garden. Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman from UW. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And Andy in Eau Claire emailed to say, I chuckled in the past when the Vickers talked about how the topsy-turvy is a gadget that doesn't work. I've tried with little success in the past to grow tomatoes in the topsy-turvy, but I took their jibes as a challenge. I also vowed that this year would be my last at wasting time with them. The topsy-turvy's not the Vickers. This year, I planted two cherry tomatoes and a Jet Star in them. I put them in more sun this year, and I've enclosed a picture of one of the cherry tomatoes. I was hoping the Vickers would be on later in the year so I could enclose a picture with tomatoes to prove that the gadget can work. But it does have blossoms. We don't have the photo. We have to believe. And Judith would have seen the photo, and she would vouch for...
That is the magic of radio. Because we can say that we've seen the photo and it didn't.
So anyway, the topsy-turvy can work, Jim. And for those who don't know what we're talking about, and probably most people do, but if you don't know what we're talking about, it's essentially an upside-down planting. You plant the tomato seeds, or the plant, upside down, and then you hang it, and it looks pretty. Looks kind of nice.
You've pretty much defined the way I described it as well. It is upside down and odd.
Mike in Madison has a question for you. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Or afternoon, almost afternoon. Quick question for you. I'm growing a bunch of cucumbers in the garden. This year, I decided to go overboard and grow 30, 40 plants of one specific kind, which is not too common to Wisconsin. It's a Mexican sour gherkin. It's about a grape-sized cucumber plant, or produces grape-sized cucumbers. And it's a slow-yielding plant. It takes a long time to fruit. But this year, it started fruiting really early. I got in early. It was doing great. But now it seems as if all the little cucumbers, they're about the size of Tic Tacs right now, and they keep drying up on the vines. Now, the plants have been watered well, and the plants themselves are doing phenomenal. 6-8 feet tall, just growing better than they have in years.
Is there a daylight? That's
but
good.
The fruit itself is drying up on the vine before it actually gets to reach its pickable size. And I was wondering if there's something I'm missing in the I don't know why it's not growing well.
So it's and you're watering it properly, and so you're not, it's not drying out from lack of water.
Are you sure it's Cucumis sativa? So you think, are you sure it's a cucumber, not a? There are some related species, and that are, you know, that look somewhat like a cucumber, and those are some of those are extremely bitter.
I'm not sure what the actual Latin name, but it's a Mexican sour gherkin, otherwise known as the mouse melon. It's a viney plant.
Of course, you know, the cucumber is not native to Mexico, so those are probably introduced or very likely, you know, at the very least is a feral species. And I suspect that when they call it the sour melon, I bet that they're referring to the fact that it is fairly high in the, or maybe very susceptible to producing high levels of cucurbitacin. I really am not familiar with it. I've seen wild cucumbers in Central America, and I have avoided them because I simply assumed that they would be inedible.
Yeah. I'm just looking it up here as we're speaking, and there's a bit of day length sensitivity in the cucumber. And if they are adapted to a more tropical environment like Mexico, they're going to prefer a shorter day for fruiting.
Right.
And so that's maybe why your plants are so large but aren't going reproductive in the way that you
well
want.
Well, the other thing is fertilizer. I mean, if you're throwing a lot of nitrogen fertilizer at it, you're going to get a lot of plant growth. And maybe not so much
in the spring. In the spring, I fertilize it pretty well with a good mix of horse manure and humus.
Okay, well, yeah, that's a good.
My guess is it's a day length. These are adapted.
It could be. You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, Erlewin, because one of the vegetables that I have for decades been trying to grow here in Wisconsin is the chayote.
But that's also a day length
sensitive. It's super sensitive to day for a photo period. And when he described his plants as being, you know, giant and verdant and green, this is exactly what happens to me. I get these plants that are this. One plant will cover, you know, a country mile, but there you not one flower.
Yeah, and so what's happening there in biologically is that the short night that we're having in our summer, okay, it's a long day or short night, is not conducive to flowering and fruiting. Yeah. And in fact, that plant is adapted to a much longer night or shorter day in order to fruit.
Yes. Erwin, I will say that this is such a testament to my academic career because I did do an experiment that I've never been able to repeat. And that was, you know what I did? I grafted chayote. I'm Mr. Vegetable Grafting.
You are, yes.
I grafted the chayote onto a squash, and all of a sudden we had chayotes.
It fruits, yes.
It did fruit. Mm-hmm. Right? Unfortunately, I take very careful notes. I forgot what I grafted onto, and I've never been able to repeat the experiment. But one summer we did get them.
Oh man! Thanks a lot for calling, Mike. I think the guys have got it here. I think it's daylight, a day length. And you know what? In the southern climes, there it's 6 o'clock or thereabouts. It just goes. It's like somebody turned off the light switch down there and it goes dark.
That's right. Jim's suggestion, though, might be something, if the caller is interested, you could perhaps graft this onto a regular cucumber, right? And then maybe you'd get fruits.
Might. It's worth a try.
Yep.
Why not?
Yep.
Thanks a lot for calling. Our guest today, the Vickers of Vegetables, Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer, on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking vegetables today with our Vickers of Vegetables, Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman, Larry Mueller here. Lynn and Eau Claire, we give you a chance now. Hi there. Thank you very much for calling.
Thank you, Larry and Vickers. And I apologize for not having a haiku, but I do have a piece of poetry that, it's not mine, it's Pablo Neruda's Ode to an Artichoke, and it makes my weekly excursions to the farmer's market, an exotic endeavor.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful.
Well, let's hear it.
Huge. I don't have it in front of me. I'm in my car.
Oh.
So you got some homework.
Remember we read Pablo Neruda's Ode to the Tomato? We did that on this show. We did.
Yeah.
You know, remember the knife plunging in? It was graphic.
It
was
visceral.
Graphic. Yeah, it was. Mm-hmm. But the Alcachofa, I think I've certainly seen that one, but I can't do Neruda just off the top of my head.
Well, how about if we pull that up here?
Judith, somebody will find it. Judith's probably already got it, but if you can find it, I tell you what, stay listening, Lynn. We may well come up with it. In the meantime, there are a couple of garden poems that I thought one I can read. And then Beverly and Superior, we'll get to you in just a minute. And Steve and Madison, you too. But here's a garden poem from Jill in Mineral Point. For weeks, the corn has stood desperate, parched, row upon row, leaves folded and raised in fervent prayer. Corn mother, send us rain. Tonight, she said, yes. That is very nice.
Wow, the leaves folded in prayer. This is...
Full and raised in fervent prayer. Corn mother, send us rain. Tonight, she said, yes.
Thank God for
Jill
English
Jill Mineral
majors.
Point, thank you very much for that. And here's a haiku. This one comes on Facebook from Amy. Hello, crispy plant. What were you before the rain stopped for many weeks?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Should I join in with my haiku for this
Why don't
morning?
You join in with yours?
Rain is not falling. Our verdant green diminished. Fewer melons, but sweeter.
Fewer melons, but sweeter.
Did I break your computer?
I'm sure you did.
We just that's nice. You wrote that yourself.
Yes, I did. Thank you.
and Erwin, did you find the?
I did. Yeah, it's here. Would you like to read it in Spanish or in English?
Oh no, you read it. Didn't last time we read it in English and Spanish?
Yeah,
but that was. I think the English version. Go for it.
No, you go. This is all you.
The
Jim.
Artichoke.
Yeah.
Of delicate heart. Erect in its battle dress builds, its minimal cup keeps stark in its scallop of scales. Around it, demonic vegetables bristle, their thickness devise, tendrils and befries, the bulb's agitations, while the subsoil. Oh, heavens, I can't go on, Erwin. This is too emotional.
Well, wait a minute, you have to fit it. While the subsoil.
No, it's the subsoil. Then it ends. The poem ends right there. That was Neruda, you know? I mean, but what, you know, but he's such a fanatic for, you know, love poetry. I don't see that in here.
Well, we have Beverly in Superior who has a question. Ooh. And Erwin, it's probably for Erwin. Let's go. Let's see.
Oh,
Bev, hi. Beverly, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, we live about 15 miles south of Superior, so we don't get the air conditioning from the lake. But we're having trouble with root crops, trying to grow beets and radishes and things like that. They just don't seem to do well at all. Can I ask what we could do to our soil? We normally just rely on a river for watering, so we figure that gives the ground its nutrients.
So you get water from the river and bring it up for watering it?
Pardon me?
So you get some water from the river and use that for your watering?
Yes, we do.
Is it just this year or is this every year?
Pardon me?
Is it just this year that you're experiencing the trouble or is it every year?
No, we've tried this about three different years and same trouble every time.
All right. Well, could you describe what happens? I mean, do the plants not thrive or?
They have trouble even coming out of the ground.
Well, I wonder if you have a crusting on your soil. I mean, is your soil very clayey? Does it crust?
We have clay and sand mix, yes, but we usually, wherever we plant, we usually put some mulch on top, some grass clippings, and things like that.
Hmm. And so it doesn't have a hard crust.
No.
Mm-hmm. Well, it might be just the quality of the soil too.
Anything special I could add to it?
Well, you can always add organic matter to the soil.
Anything, yeah, compost to make it much more, you know, and tillage. I mean, what kind of, do you till the soil prior to planting?
Not with a tiller, usually by hand with one of those weasel type things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's good. But I agree with Larry. I think if you can work some compost in there and prepare a seed bed that's light, and that has, you know, so where roots can penetrate, I think that's very important.
Okay.
Beets especially, they will not, you know, do very well pushing out of a hard soil. So I think making your soil lighter could be very useful.
All right, real good. And then I have a question about an insect that was bothering my strawberries. It was a lime green, very small worm, moved like an inchworm, and it would make tracks right on the strawberries and eat holes in the leaves. It was only about a quarter of an inch, half inch long.
Can we get Phil Filateri on the phone quickly?
Mm. Yeah.
I don't know about strawberry insects.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
That one we can't help you with.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
I think there's great potential, however, with that for a haiku.
Actually, Phil is on Tuesday, coming up on Tuesday of this coming week. So stay listening, call back, and he will probably have an answer there. Stephen Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, I can't think of any haiku for you.
Well, that's all right.
We were just harvesting some Chinese cabbage last night and found it kind of infested with earwigs, other little bugs, and so forth. Almost so much that it's impractical to clean it and use it. So we were wondering whether there's some magic process that we're missing, some way to get rid of the earwigs and other little bugs either before or after harvesting cabbage and products like that.
You know, I think what's happening is that, you know, this year we're going to have a very different, it's just simply going to be a different ecology, and there are going to be insects and pathogens that are going to be well adapted to high temperatures and, you know, low rainfall. We're going to have an abundance of those, and many of the insects that and pests that we've had in the past, you know, in rainier, cooler years, I mean, no one this year has, the word Phytophthora has not come up at all,
right?
And nor will it, right? So, in fact, I'm sorry to say that simply, you know, gardening, as we've indicated, Erwin and I, it's an adventure in applied ecology, and this year it's, our environment has changed, and you're going to favor some of those other critters that in the past have been, either haven't flourished or have been consumed by other bigger critters. So I don't have offering a solution for you.
Hmm.
I wish they were tasty. What about who's that Zimmerman? He does that odd thing with that crazy foods. Maybe you could call him.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling. And Joanne and Lac de Flambeau, turning to you now. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I'm having a problem with my zucchini. They get to be about 5-6 inches long. About the size, a big around as a quarter, and then they all start rotting from the end.
Yeah, that's blossom end rot. Huh?
Yeah,
blossom end rot is a big problem this year. A lot of people are reporting it in their gardens, and it's a disease. It's a problem due to the failure of calcium to move from the leaves into the fruit. Well, the fruits need calcium in order to develop, and the movement of calcium is coincident with water movement, and when there's drought and poor water, you get blossom end rot.
So we have been, our garden isn't that big, so we've basically been carrying water over every day and watering stuff, and we always water not over the top of the plant, you know, just down by the roots. Mm-hmm. So is there anything else we can do?
Well, it's a tough one because you sort of need a consistent supply of water for this to combat this problem. And in years where, you know, it's very, very dry, you bet your plants are drying out in between the waterings. It's a tough situation. But I think that's probably what you have.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for the info.
Yep, sure. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Tom in Rib Mountain up next. Tom, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. A little haiku for Kale. Kale to Kale, bibs and aprons waiting for the splash of sauce. And my question for the Victors this morning is
yes.
Recipes for kale, if we can.
You know,
and
what?
And a little tidbit, diatomaceous earth, food grade, sprinkled on the leaves for those problems with those insects may go a long way to helping deter them in the garden. I'll hang up and listen on the air. All right.
Thanks a lot for calling.
Well, Jim hates kale. But
what an optimist to think that kale is edible.
But I just want to share my, I think that kale, one of my favorite things to do is to make the kale chip. Have you had kale chips?
Describe this delicacy for me.
The kale chip, you basically chop up your kale into small pieces. You sprinkle some oil over it and some salt, maybe a little bit of olive oil, a little bit of coarse salt, and then you put them on a baking sheet at high temperature, and you basically crisp that kale.
And any leftovers can be used for home heating in the winter?
It's very tasty.
Awful.
Larry, have you ever had the kale chips?
Yes, I have.
They're good.
I like them.
Yeah, I think even you would. You might enjoy it. Or you might, I don't know, you might want to use it as a mulch.
You have to sneak it in so he wouldn't know what it was to begin with. And then he'd say, this is good. What's this?
I'm so open-minded about these things.
Yeah.
But just put them on a baking sheet with a little oil and salt, and the oven I don't think needs to be very hot.
No.
And it just crisps them up, and they're tasty.
Kale is an ornament. It's not a vegetable. You don't eat it. You put something edible on the top of it. It's a napkin.
Yeah, it's...
Okay, I'm sorry.
Ron, let's try to something else. Let's go to Ron in Sauk City. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you for calling.
I'm sitting here admiring my garden, and it has become, I'm starting to refer to it as a pet, because I love it, I water it, I feed it, yet I can't eat it. So I have my green beans or my yellow beans or have been in blossom now for a couple weeks, and I'm getting no beans. And tomatoes are doing great. Cucumbers are doing great. My beets are doing well. Potatoes appear to be, but, broccoli, cauliflower, cabbages, those kind of things just aren't going to make it, I don't believe.
You know, a lot of the vegetables that are, stems or leaves are doing well this year. Although cucumbers, ironically, I would agree with you. I was surprised to find that they're doing well. But a lot of vegetables that are, are ovaries, right? A lot of the flowers are aborting.
Yeah.
Right? They're going to be tomatoes, but they're going to be a lot fewer tomatoes. Right? That's going to be our issue. There's going to be green beans. There's simply going to be fewer of them because the flowers are going to be aboard. So I'm really looking forward to the fall, and I hope people will. I'm going to go out and plant my beets this afternoon. Irwin,
yeah, that's a way to go.
And I think we're going to look forward to, I think we're just going to have faith.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Why not?
Well, I'm looking forward to borscht, so I better plant some more beets.
All right.
Only about half of them germinated.
Well, you'll get better beets if you plant them now. Those
super
beets that you harvest in the fall are going to be nice and sweet.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Debbie in Green Bay, hello to you.
Hi. I have a question. I like to experiment every year planting different things. So I planted a broccoli plant. Do I get one head of broccoli from each plant, or does it get more?
You'll get one main head, right? But if you cut that one off, the lateral buds will break, and you'll get more in the fall. In fact,
okay,
that's what I do. I often plant early broccoli, and especially this year, I'm sure no one is going to have any edible broccoli that's going to be functional, right?
Right.
But I would say cut it back, and the lateral buds would break, and I'm looking forward to fall broccoli.
Okay, because I do have a head of broccoli already, so I'll just cut that one off. And then I should get more.
It's edible, you could try it, but the quality is simply not there because these high temperatures, are just going to create some problems.
Okay. And then the other thing, I just had a comment on the zucchini. I planted a summer squash this year, and I had a lot of end rot, so I stopped watering it, and I've been getting yellow zucchini like crazy.
Huh.
So for the other lady that called in, maybe she's, like I said, I used to water mine every day or twice a day, and then I had like three or four of them that kept getting that end rot, so I stopped watering it, And now I water maybe once a week, and I've gotten four huge yellow zucchini, about 8 to 10 inches long already.
Oh.
So who knows?
Who knows? Mm-hmm. Worth a try. It's a good experiment. Thanks, Debbie.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye. Appreciate the call. Now we have open lines. We get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. We have there's one vegetable that Jim is not a big fan of. It's purple.
Oh, not deep. Those aren't edible either.
not really.
No, not really. Yeah, why people do that, I don't know.
There's a little Facebook item from Peggy about that vegetable, and it goes, purple egg. Dog won't eat it either. Compost fodder now. So it sounds like she's agreeing with you.
Peggy nailed it. Yeah.
And here, did I read the haiku from on the crispy plant? Hello, crispy plant. What were you before the rain stopped for many weeks? That's from Amy again.
These are good for you, Amy. I like the plant. I like the leaves in prayer, though. I think that was an appropriate end poem.
And on Facebook, Bill says, I already bought my Newski's bacon. How many more weeks do I need to wait before the tomatoes show up in the farmer's market? Shouldn't be that long.
No, they're here. I mean, our CSA, we picked up our CSA, which, by the way, is from Primrose Valley Farms, and it is they're doing a great job this year in a tough year. And we had big tomatoes as well as the small tomatoes in our bag yesterday.
Well, I've been harvesting tomatoes.
Mm-hmm. From your garden, were they under a hoop house or a greenhouse?
No, they're potted, out of pots.
Okay.
And one plant has got blossom end rot. The other one's fine. The other three are fine.
It's just that, you know, the high temperatures, you're going to get pollen blasting. You know, pollen blasting is where the pollen simply doesn't function, right? It's an energetic little tissue, and in these high temperatures, it will basically burn up before it can affect fertilization. Mm-hmm. That will happen in tomatoes. It'll happen in peppers. It'll happen in a lot of vegetables. And then also you'll get, simply abortion, right, of the flowers themselves. So my guess is that we will get, you know, we will certainly get tomatoes and peppers and many other vegetables. We're just going to get probably fewer of them. And what's going to happen is if it starts to rain, we'll start to get what they call split sets, right? You'll get a few fruit set early. You'll get many more fruit set late. Those are things that may happen. One of the good things is, though, that very likely, you know what's going to be a good year for, I bet? Is going to be watermelons and melons they're going to be so much sweeter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the watermelons, oh, man, we had watermelon the other night. It was just so sweet.
Mm-hmm. Well, from your garden already?
No, not from our garden.
Okay.
It was from the garden of whoever sells to Jennifer Street Market.
Ah, okay. Okay, someone in Arizona. But, you know, we often get our water, you know, the finer watermelons and melons are often imported from the Southwest, where they have basically Madison's climate every year, right? I mean, very hot and very little moisture, and that generates a higher sugar content, mm-hmm. right, in their fruits. And so this year, I suspect, that's why my haiku, didn't I say that? Fewer melons, but sweeter.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, speaking of melons, Brian in La Crosse, hi to you. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, it's kind of just ironic that you guys are talking about that. I've grown watermelons twice now, and basically this time it's just taken over my entire garden. And I don't know when is the proper time to go ahead and pick them, and how do you know if they're ripe?
Wow. See, watermelon is not an easy crop to determine. You know, what they actually do in melon and watermelon fields commercially is they actually, you know, they cut in and they probe them, and mm-hmm. then they know when to harvest and it's higher field.
Do they measure
field.
Sugars, measure bricks? They measure the bricks. Right. Yeah. And that's a device you can use is if you take a little probe, a little refractometer.
The trouble is once you've done the probe,
that's the end of it.
So how do you test? Well, you look at the bot. You roll them over And what you'll often see is that, you know, that yellow carotene, where the, you know, you'll see the yellow carotenoid pigments.
Yes.
And when that becomes intense, then you'll have a sense that if that yellow carotenoid on the outside of the melon is intensely colored, then you have a sense that the other pigments on the inside, like lycopene, are also being generated, and that's probably a good indicator of maturity in a watermelon, and it's non-destructive. That's what I do, at any rate.
Okay.
Well, I probably got about 10 of them ready then.
All right. Well, have some fun with them.
Roll the melon over and look for that intensive yellow pigment, right, where there's no sun.
Right? And then there's some good recipes out there for watermelon soup.
I've never had that.
Yeah, there's a cold watermelon soup that's really good. So if you're looking for ways to use up those 10, Brian, you might go online, and Judith will probably come up with a recipe for it.
Does that soup involve alcohol at all? Isn't it a vodka? Larry calls it watermelon soup. It's actually just watermelon cubes and vodka.
No, I don't think so. But that could probably work too, Brian.
Thank you very kindly.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. The watermelon soup is really good, especially if you've got a good watermelon to begin with. Dan in Jackson County, it's your turn. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I've been watering, quite a bit with this weather, and I have my tomato. I've got a walnut tree in my garden, so I've been doing a bunch of my tomatoes in some big pots.
Yeah.
And I've been watering a lot, and I've got that bottom rot on the tomatoes. And I talked to an agent, and they said, well, you're losing calcium by watering as much as we're watering right now. And my question, I guess, is if I'm losing calcium and I bought some calcium to put on, what can I do, and can I replenish that for next year's crop, for next year's planting?
Most of the soils in Wisconsin have plenty of calcium. At least that's my understanding. So typically, you don't need to amend the soil with calcium. I think the real issue is the consistency of watering. Well, at least that's my sense, Jim. What do you think?
Yeah, I think I agree with you.
Okay. Yeah. What's consistent?
What is the issue with the walnut tree, though?
Well, the jug line would create a problem for.
Right.
You can't grow stuff underwater.
Yeah.
Okay. I was just confused. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. Now, yeah. I had
but
that problem.
What do you mean by consistency?
Well, yeah. What Irwin's implying is that you're going to have blossom end rot whenever you have wide variations in the moisture content. And so you might water. The trouble is you're going to water, then the plant gets too much, then it gets too little. This is what causes blossom end rot. What Irwin is suggesting is that you need something to moderate the amount of moisture in the soil. One way to do that is to compost the heck out of your soils as well. Is that right, Irwin?
Yeah, I think that'll help with the consistency of moisture. Jim's right. It's the fluctuation when you get too wet, too dry, too wet, too dry, and that often happens with this sort of episodic watering that we do. That's where you get the calcium problem, and that's what causes the blossom end rot.
Okay. What do you think about if in my pots, if I would take like a quart bottle, because I've been watering almost every day, I have to. I put the water down at the bottom, at the ground level, but take a quart bottle, put some holes in it, fill it up, and set that in there, and just do that every night, about a quart of water for a plant in a big pot, giant pot.
So you might get too much water then. It's really, potted vegetables are very susceptible to just this particular issue, right, which is wide variations in moisture. It's almost impossible to provide.
Tough. Yeah. It's tough. I mean, Larry himself mentioned that he has some tomatoes in pots,
yep,
and he's got one of them that's got blossom end rot, but he does have some of them that are working well. And so my guess is you'd experience something similar where it can work, but you can also find yourself with the problem.
No, I am having some beautiful tomatoes and beautiful plants. I used a new variety, I think it's new, out of University of Oregon, which is called Indigo Rose, and they're purple.
Oh, yes.
And those are supposed to have all the stuff. Every good thing in blueberries and tomatoes are in that.
Yeah.
So anyway, they look wonderful, and I haven't eaten one yet because they're not ripe, and I'm waiting till they're completely purple. But they do not seem
to be having any problem at all. And I'm treating them the same as all of my other tomatoes.
Yeah, so that's good to know.
And pleased with. And that was the first time that I ever planted from seeds to try to do tomatoes. And, oh, that's a pain in the neck. I got to get somebody to grow the plants for me, you know, start them out for me, and, you know, that does that.
Yeah, a lot of the varieties of tomatoes developed at Oregon. That's why Jim Myers, he's been working on that. You've been trying to complement the, you know, the carotenoid content with the anthocyanins, thinking that, you know, they would have a much higher.
Right, it's a high anthocyanin and high carotenoid tomato. And I should mention the breeder of that tomato, Jim Myers. Jim just mentioned him. He was a student here at Wisconsin.
Cool.
Went out to Oregon State University. He's now breeding a number of crops, including tomatoes.
In fact, most great breeders came from the University of Wisconsin.
On that note, I'm going to remind you that we're talking with the Vicars of Vegetables today, Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman. I'm Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my Vicars of Vegetables, Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman. And lots of callers online, but in the meantime, Erwin, you handed us a tomato, a little cherry tomato.
These tomatoes are from our CSA, and they're pretty good. Mm-hmm. It's been a tough year for them. A lot of watering, a lot of, you know, very difficult year. A lot of insect pests that you don't usually see, or they're much worse this year. So my hat is off to all those the fresh market vegetable farmers out there. What a tough year.
No, really tough year. Miel in River Falls, it is your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have to backtrack and say I can't forgive you for your comment on kale. It's just a napkin.
You don't eat it?
Yes, of course you eat it.
Well, I'm one of those anarcho hippies, so we've eaten a lot of kale.
Good for you.
Okay. So my question is, we're growing cucumbers in a hoop house.
Okay.
And they have a mystery disease. They're trellised upwards, and their leaves are turning brown, and they're getting dusty and kind of cobwebby, and the fruit is similar.
Yeah, that's powdery mildew. Yeah, it's going to be that's the disease you're going to get when it's hot and dry, and you're going to get
powdery
that on
mildew.
Not just on cucumbers, but also there's nothing. I don't think you could spray anything to really recover it. I think you're just going to have to accept fewer cucumbers, and that gives you an opportunity to enjoy more dishes based on kale.
That's right. Yeah. All right, appreciate it very much.
All right, thanks a lot for calling, Miel. Patricia and Muscadet. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you. I have a question. I planted cucumbers this year for the first time.
Yeah.
And they're growing beautifully, but when I go to eat them, they're bitter.
Really bitter? Yeah.
Really bitter.
Yeah.
And there's like no seeds in them. They're very little seeds in the middle.
Well, are they misshapen at all?
No, they're beautiful because I have them on a fence and they're coming down nice and, you know, straight. And I've let them grow a little bigger because I thought, well, maybe it's they were too soon. I picked one. And this one was bitter, too. And it's like not juicy or anything. And I've been watering them.
The bitterness is due to the, you know, just the high temperatures and stress, the lack of point. Anytime you have a stress on any type of a cucurbit, and especially the cucumber, they will increase the production of their defense compound, which is this I think it's the bitterest, isn't it the bitterest compound on Earth?
It is. This is called cucurbitacin, right?
Mm. Yeah.
So now, will they all be bitter, or will they just...
It's going to vary, right? It's going to be the cucumbers that are developed, and, you know, and in the actual fruit itself, you'll often find that it's at the, I think it's at the, is it the blossom end? Anyway, there's a gradient actually within the fruits themselves where you can find, you know, higher levels of the cucurbitacin. What you're going to find is that fruit developing over at a different period of time may not be at all bitter.
Oh, okay. Right. So then I shouldn't rip them out.
Right. Don't rip them out. Don't go to the kale yet.
Oh, no. Don't worry. I never will.
If they have bigger flowers, though, now maybe we could try something new, right? They have such tiny little flowers that you could make very delicate little cucumber flower
tempura.
I'd like to try it, but I don't think it would work.
I think go for the squash flower tempura.
Yeah, I think you stick with
it. And
that.
Heaven forbid that we would ever make kale tempura.
No.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right, thanks a lot, Patricia. Liz in Viroqua, hi.
Hi. I'm calling for all those eggplant fans out there.
All right.
Oh, for the one other person?
I've always had a problem with flea beetles out here in rural Viroqua. But this year, I took some tree containers, big plastic pots, black, and planted them in potting soil, and I've been eating great eggplants for the last 3 weeks.
You have?
Yes.
Wow.
I had to fence them off against the deer and the rabbits, of course, because they'll eat anything. And I'm thinking, ooh, with this last caller, should I fry the flowers?
I think the flowers on cucumbers would be actually way too bitter.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
For to make a tempura.
No, I'm joking.
You want to use squash flowers.
Yeah, I'm joking. Yeah.
And I apologize that we can't share your passion for the eggplant.
Oh,
but you defined it
exactly.
These
eggplants, grown in this way, they are so fabulous.
Oh, yeah.
I can't even imagine how they could be fabulous, but...
I cook Italian,
Yeah, eggplant parmesan.
Oh, that's right. So, in other words, if you're able to kill the actual flavor and texture of the eggplant with other ingredients, it then becomes edible.
But
right?
When you grow them, they aren't bitter.
Yeah. Okay. They're not.
No.
I can see that we're generating some anger here on the radio waves.
No, not anger. I'm just... Okay. Trying to win a convert. Anyway, thanks for the program.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Liz, for calling. Appreciate it. And Robert in Bayview, hello to you.
I got to answer this call. Hello?
Hi. Robert, how are you doing? What's on your mind?
Well, I've got some potatoes that I planted last year that I didn't plant again this year.
Okay.
They are showing up, and I'm wondering... I didn't dig them all out, and I've got a lot of them.
Oh.
I don't know how deep they are. They've been flowering for a long time. I don't know much about potatoes at all. I just planted them. So
the ones you harvest this year, will they be edible? Well, sure.
Correct. And when are they edible, and what's the deal with the flowers? What is that? Because I have one plant that's probably very large. And it's been flowering on and off for at least 2 months.
Well, potatoes will produce flowers. Of course, we don't generally care about that because mm-hmm. they produce a little fruit, but we don't really pay much attention to it. But I don't see any reason why a potato that that overwintered.
Yeah, volunteer. We call those volunteer potatoes, and there shouldn't be any problem with enjoying those.
Yeah, same with onions sometimes. Mm-hmm. If you leave a few in the garden.
The onion will vernalize, so it'll flower.
A lot of those will
whereas
bolt.
The potato won't.
Right.
Right. So I think, I can't imagine there would be any real problem there.
Yeah.
I'm curious, how deep could they possibly be, and when is the proper time to dig them then? Because, as you plant tomatoes, I know they rise up, and then you have to keep...
They're going to be within easily diggable or scrapable soil, and mm-hmm. I would say that probably any, as long as you've got some nice moisture, if they're not drying out, I would eat them from now on until the...
Probably the size of a golf ball right now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Probably the size of a golf ball, and I like that size.
There's no time to harvest them in particular.
No.
They're just going to get bigger.
Just whenever whatever size you're looking for.
Great. Okay.
Yeah, enjoy.
Enjoy.
Yeah, I will.
So much better than eggplant or kale.
Thanks a lot for calling. Jill and Rhinelander, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to put in my 2 cents worth about tomatoes.
Yeah.
I grow mine in those earth boxes in a greenhouse, and up until this year, I've had a problem with blossom end rot. And the grow boxes, you put all this fertilizer and dolomite and everything in, supposed to be balanced. This year, I put eggshells in with the tomato plants, and I have had very little problem with blossom end rot.
Hmm.
So I think the eggshells have helped.
Yeah, when did you put the eggshells in?
When I put in the transplants, when I planted the plants.
I suspect, that they probably would have more of an effect later, right? In
I don't know,
years.
Probably
you've had just a good year of maintaining a good moisture content, right?
No, it's, with the grow boxes, you
you water every day, and the moisture comes up from the bottom. It's consistent.
Hmm. So,
with earth boxes, so okay. The plants do not dry out.
Cool. Yeah, well, that's good. But I was thinking the eggshells, the calcium wouldn't be released from the eggshells.
No. Not this year.
Immediately, they'd be released like next year, by next year.
Well, I don't know, but last year and the year before, I had blossom end rot like crazy, and this year I do not.
Oh man, am I glad to hear that?
And I put the calcium or the eggshells in when I put in the plants, so I don't know.
Well, I would keep doing it. If it's working, I would keep doing it. That's
good advice. Sounds like you've solved the problem.
And the powdery mildew with the cucumbers. I have cucumbers in the same greenhouse, and they were getting the powdery mildew, and I went to a garden store, and I got a spray to put on them, and it halted the mildew.
Ooh. Okay.
So it does. There is a fungicide out there that works.
I'm just too cheap to buy that stuff. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Jill, for calling. Appreciate that call and those comments. Visiting today with Irwin Goldman and Jim Nienhuis, the Vicars of Vegetables from the University of Wisconsin-Madison Horticulture Department. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gardening can be a joy and a frustration, sometimes both at the same time. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad you could join us for another edition of Garden Talk here on the Ideas Net. My guests until 12:30 are the Vicars of Vegetables, Irwin Goldman and Jim Nienhuis from the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture, and they have some great advice on how to keep your garden alive in the drought conditions. And they want to encourage you to write some poetry, maybe a haiku about your garden while you're at it. And you can give it to us in person by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also ask your questions there. Or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and click like while you're there as well, and we'll send you regular updates. But you can post your garden haiku there as well. And guys, there's a picture on the Facebook page that a listener posted. And says our potato plants seem to be developing potatoes on the plants. if not, what are they? And they pose this picture. Yeah. And for everybody else, you should go and take a look at my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and take a look at this.
Those are the fruits that the potato plant produces. And that's a good sign. Your plants have flowered and fruited. Of course, those fruits are really inedible. They're going to be super bitter. But they do have small potato seeds in them, and that is yet
almost minuscule small.
Yeah,
potato
tiny,
seeds
tiny seeds like poppy seeds, and those things, you know, could be used, of course, to produce a potato plant. But your potatoes are underground where they should be, and
yeah.
Those tubers could be dug, and you can probably dig down right now and find some of those tubers there as we speak.
Mm-hmm. There we go, Sonny and Dousman. Now we are on to you. Hi, Sonny.
Hi. I live in an apartment, and so I have three huge calf barrels out on my sidewalk, and I filled them with dirt, and I've planted stuff in them, and we've had good harvests in the past, but this year, of course, it's pretty bad. So now I hear you saying that we can plant now for fall harvest, and I'm wondering what kind of vegetables really do well in half barrels?
And, yeah. Well, you can pretty much anything, I think.
I think so, too. I don't think you should be limited.
Well, I know tomatoes do all well. Okay, they didn't this year.
Mm-hmm.
I put potatoes in this year, which I hadn't done before, and I got very small potatoes that were kind of blue, which I didn't expect because that's not what the seed potatoes looked like.
Mm-hmm.
No, that is disturbing.
And my carrots are nowhere, too. You know, I mean, they just...
That's a hard, yeah, that would be a hard one to do. And, you know, a carrot, for example, would be hard to start now unless you wanted to produce something, you know, that would be very small. I would look at spinach. I would look at radishes. I would look at beets, chard. What about a fall pea crop?
Oh, that might be possible.
You could do in a container. I think a fall pea crop.
Radishes.
Would be
good.
Radishes, yeah. Try those.
All righty.
All right. Thanks.
That's good. And then because I've used these barrels now for about 3 years, What do I have to do to make sure that the soil just doesn't get depleted?
Well, it's hard to know what you started. Did you start out with potting soil or field soil?
No, I bought garden soil up
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm. and have you
big bags.
Have you added fertilizer to it in those 3 years?
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, you're gonna probably want to do that. You're gonna probably want to mix in some fertilizer for next, either for this fall or for next spring.
I would definitely get some fertilizer in there because 3 years, it's that the fertility get leached out of because you're having to water it a lot.
Mm-hmm. Some of that composted
chicken poop.
Another
thing I'm having trouble with is I appreciated all the rain we have because I have high water bills here. It's an apartment building, and the water bill is shared by the 8 apartments, not by the number of people in them.
Oh.
Yeah. So I live alone, but there are 5 people in one apartment and 3 in another. And
Well, to balance that out, shouldn't you abuse your water then?
No, it'll just go higher. And
it'll be just higher.
But won't they be paying a fifth of that? Or 4/5 of that?
Well,
you can see how I think.
Oh, man.
I thought of that. Believe me.
Thanks, Sonny. Good luck, by the way. Appreciate your call. Oh, man. Carol in West Allis. Hi.
Hey. Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a small garden in West Dallas, and I have 5 tomato plants in my garden.
Okay.
Two of them are wilting, and they're wilting mostly during the day. In the evening, they seem to perk up, and in the morning, again, they're wilting. So do I have the dreaded tomato wilt, or what is going on?
Boy, do you have a constant moisture content? I mean, that sounds classically like the response of the plant. I mean, this is what my tomatoes were doing in my irrigated garden.
And the other tomato plants are not wilting. They are fine, and I've been watering them.
But there could be a little variation in you can't see under the soil, and you can't tell that there's maybe more and more moisture available for some of the plants than to some of the others. That could be a possibility. It sounds to me like, I doubt that you've got fusarium, right? I think what you've got is probably just a reaction to the variation in the moisture content in the soil. What do you think, Erwin?
Yeah, I mean, what would it be? Fusarium or verticillium would be the two potential wilt diseases. But I think you'd know if you had those.
And those are the kind of diseases that aren't just going to show up this year. I mean, that would be those are California.
Yeah.
Where you have these desert-like environments every year.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's going to be.
I agree with you. I think it's unlikely to have those wilt diseases.
But I think the recovery and the wilting is all about moisture.
Okay. All right. But even
so, I would mulch that. I would definitely. I would just mulch the heck out of your garden. And that's going to be. That'll help you this year, and it'll help you in every future year. I'm like Mr. Mulch.
I did mulch to start with. I did the newspaper with layers of things on it, but now, of course, it's deteriorated.
Go get those leaf clippings and get those from your local municipality and just pile them out. See, I'm not shy about mulching. For me, mulching is not measured in inches; it's feet.
Okay, I'll follow your good advice. Okay,
thanks a lot, Carol.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. OG in Oshkosh. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for having me on. I just want to make a quick comment. I haven't caught all the show, but we were talking about eggplants. And when I lived on the farm, we used to pickle them in jars.
Mm-hmm.
And, we called them Moulin John. Mm-hmm. And I live in Oshkosh now, but I go all the way back to Kenosha. There's a store, Tanuta's. And they have the eggplants pickled. They don't taste as good as my grandma's, but they're pretty close.
Ah.
Were they small? Did you pickle them when they were small?
No, they were pretty good size, but it's a lot of work. You put them in pillowcases and in your wash machine to dry them out, and it's a little bit of work to pickle them. I know that.
Are you doing laundry or pickling? Now, let me get this straight.
Well, I think you have to cut them, and then you have to dry them out really good.
The pillowcases and laundry.
And then you
little laundry soap there. Okay.
And put them on a spin cycle to get all the water out of them.
Oh.
Oh, man.
Which just goes to prove my point that you can, you know, I mean, you could take cotton balls, right, and do the same. If you pickled a cotton ball, you could get, you know, what do cats produce, like fur balls? You could probably get the same thing. This is the equivalent of kale. I'm sorry. I naturally assumed that the whole radio program was going to gravitate towards the tempura squash flowers, and yet we seem to be focusing on the eggplant and kale. This is disturbing to me.
I love eggplant. Eggplant is great.
I like it too. Thanks a lot for calling.
Thanks for the show.
Appreciate it. Amy in Blue Mountain said, I was in the buffet line at a fundraiser recently when a chef and fellow guest noticed that I was picking out the baby carrots and turnips from a lovely salad, avoiding the beets.
Oh, wow. This is
for you. He asked me if beets taste like dirt to me, and I said they do. Oh, now what did I do? Blast it all.
Irwin can answer it now. He doesn't need even.
Wait a minute. Where did they go? I said they taste exactly like dirt, and they do to the chef as well. And he told me that there's a certain percentage of people who have a genetic trait that causes beets to taste like dirt. Now maybe my father will believe me.
Well, there's a lot of truth in that. Not 100%, but beets have an earthy taste. They taste like soil because they're carrying a compound called geosmin, which is spelled G-E-O-S-M-I-N, geosmin, which is the earth scent. That's the scent of soil. When you turn over soil in the spring, you smell geosmin. And geosmins are made by Streptomyces bacteria that live naturally in the soil, and they happen to also like beet. They congregate around beet roots. And so you get the earthiness from the bacteria that produce the geosmins. I think people are exquisitely sensitive. The human nose is exquisitely sensitive to geosmin, more so than most organic compounds, and virtually everybody can sense it. It's just that people have a variable sensitivity to it. And some people really don't like it, and some people, like the Australians, they are crazy for beets. They put beets on their sandwiches, and they came to visit me recently to ask if we could produce a beet that had extremely earthy flavor, high levels of earthiness, because that's what they like. So everybody's different in the way that they perceive this compound.
That is very, very interesting. I did not know that. Mm-hmm. And what is it again?
It's called geosmin, and it is a natural compound produced in the soil. I think everybody can relate to the smell of freshly turned earth and soil. But beets and Swiss chard and spinach, to some extent, are all in the same family, and they all have some of the earthiness because this bacteria seems to like plants in that family.
I tell you, because it's barbecue or grilling season, I brought this up on the show in the past, but I just love grilled beets.
Oh, yeah, they're fantastic.
Oh, man, they're so good. So sweet.
Yeah, they are.
Oh, my goodness.
They are.
Well, I've learned a lot of things today, but that's something I have never heard before. That's great.
I think a lot of kids think beets taste like dirt, and indeed those kids are right.
And apparently Foster's.
Randy in Laval. Let's go to you. Hi, Randy.
Hi. I fortunately grew up around people that had big gardens and loved the food from that, and many droughts came, you know, four or five that I can remember, bad droughts. And they planted in a drought, they planted two gardens, one right out in the cornfield. My grandpa, I remember, said, during a drought, plant another garden out in the cornfield, and that one will really produce. And sure enough, he would come home on the tractor seat or on the tractor platform would be these big zucchinis and lots of kohlrabis, which is in that earthy. Also, I grew up eating slices of kohlrabi, and I love that earthy taste. Mm-hmm. And that the garden planted out in the corn, right in the corn rows, would always outproduce in a drought the garden planted at home. He said they seemed to know, they were Dutch in origin, they seemed to know what was going to go on with the weather. And I've often thought this year, if you could go out there, find a cornfield that was somewhere halfway doing well, and plant your garden right in that corn row, Grandpa would be smiling in heaven because, because boy, did that do well. And I don't know if you can figure out why.
Well, that's in a way, it's like the milpa system used in the tropics, right, in Central America and Mexico. But they would do it, they would grow the corn, and then later you would plant squash and beans. These are called the three sisters. Mm-hmm. And the reason that they would plant the squash and beans is that they would use the corn stalk. They would harvest the corn, then they would use the corn stalk as a support, and then they would be able to, they would get higher quality, and the fruits wouldn't be laying on the soil. So in a way, it's a classic derivation of the classic milpa system.
That's an interesting comment.
Mm. Anyway,
thanks.
Cool.
Appreciate the call. Thank you very much, Johnny in Madison. Your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. I am calling in because I'm a former student of Jim and Irwin's, and
is this the famous Johnny?
Is this Johnny Hunter?
Yeah, this is Johnny Hunter.
Oh boy! So nice to hear from you, Johnny.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to say how much I appreciate hearing you guys on the radio. I seem to get lucky and listen when you guys are on, and how much your class has an incredible influence on me. And I tell everyone who goes to university that they have to take it.
Well, fantastic.
And you don't recommend medication before or after?
Well, Johnny,
I constantly tell the story about Peter Rabbit and how I almost fell over in my chair.
Well, it's been great to see your success too. And of course, I don't know if the listeners recognize Johnny's name, but Johnny is at the Food Collective. I could tell the Underground Food Collective. Is that right?
That is correct.
The Great Chef,
which is an outstanding. I mean, this is super creative local cuisine, and we're it's an honor to hear from you.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to call in, and I was super excited to hear you guys. So,
thanks, John. Appreciate it. Well, what's this Brer Rabbit story?
How come why doesn't Johnny write the class reviews?
Yeah.
Those aren't the comments I ever get from the dean, right? It's, I never get one that says, or maybe she misinterprets those reviews.
Possibly.
Right?
Possibly.
Yeah, okay. Well, we can't go into the Brer Rabbit story here on the air.
Okay.
Suffice to say that if you see us, out in the garden, we'll be happy to share that one with you.
Brian in Appleton. Thanks.
Hi,
thanks for calling.
I had a question about rhubarb. I've had the plants for about 4 years, but they never seem to ripen. Maybe about 2 or 3 inches at the base of the stalk turns red, but it never turns red any farther than that.
Well, that could be just the type that you've got, because a lot of them don't turn.
A lot of them stay kind of a pale color,
right,
at the towards the top of the petiole. But it's still. Have you tasted them?
No, because I wasn't sure. I was always used to. I only knew rhubarb as being red when it was ripe.
Oh.
So.
Well, I think you should try them because though there's a pale. I mean, a number of the types of rhubarb have a paleness to them towards the top of the petiole, but they're still excellent.
And they're kind of getting, is it getting late for rhubarb yet?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's late
for
rhubarb now, so you might want to not do it now.
Good point. Larry's point is right. Yeah, taste them next spring. But
yeah.
That's
okay.
True.
Because they just stay green,
Yeah.
The rest of the stalk is green year-round or, during the season.
Try them
and
in the spring.
I don't know if I had a certain type of plant, because they always want to go to flower, too, for some reason.
Yeah, they will flower. I mean, a lot of them do flower here. But I think it's probably just the type they've got.
Yep.
Okay.
And so try them in the spring. If you don't like them, I'd get some new ones in there.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. If I don't like them, I'll just start over again.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks, Brian. Appreciate the call. Brant in Jefferson, what's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. We have my wife and I have 4 pots of tomatoes. One of them is cherry. They're doing great. We get a few every day. And I don't know the other 3, but one of them, it'll turn nice and red, but the bottom is
totally black. Is that the blossom end rot?
You got it.
Yeah.
And the cherry, you know, the cherry varieties are very small of fruit, and so you're going to have, they're simply, you know, it's simply not as common at all to find blossom end rot in those, in that particular types of tomatoes. You know, it's only the larger fruits where you're going to have the calcium transport problem. I mean, the cherry tomatoes are really small. So you're defining exactly what, you know, blossom end rot is.
Okay, can I cut the bottom off and still eat those?
Yeah,
sure.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. An email from Tim in Madison. I wonder if whether you guys have ever grown quinoa?
Quinoa,
of course. I tried last year, and the plants grew large and flowered, but didn't set seed. Mm-hmm. Any advice also sources for seeds?
You know, there are some people trying to grow this crop here in the Midwest. I'm not sure, you know, it's adapted to the highlands in the Andes, right?
Yeah.
And so this is not a perfect match in terms of day length. But I think there is some work going on now in the U.S. to try to develop cultivars that will work here. And I've heard some people have had
Isn't
success.
Isn't this in the Chenopodiaceae family?
It's in the Chenopodiaceae family. It's a very, very high quality nutritional grain, but not quite adapted to our environment, right?
Hmm.
You know what fascinates me about this? I don't mean to dive into another subject, but, you know, there are some families of vegetables that were domesticated all over the world, and some were not. And Chenopodiaceae is one of those.
Yes.
I mean, what are the other common members of the Chenopodiaceae family?
Well, you've got the prickly pear cactus on the one hand. You've got the quinoa from the Andes. You've got the table beet and Swiss chard from the Mediterranean. So, I mean, all over the world.
Yeah.
Really, it's a fascinating family.
Yeah, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Eric in Lindsay, Wisconsin, a quick question from you.
Sure. I'd like to know more about growing hops.
Wouldn't we all?
Yeah. We have, yeah.
I think Larry can answer this question without any help from us, Erwin.
I tell you, we were in England. We were spent 4 or 5 days in County Kent here a few weeks ago, and that is sort of a hops growing center of the world. Hops require a lot of water and a lot of fertilizer, and require a lot of trellising because they grow. The plants themselves grow very, very tall.
Yeah, I have some by my flagpole, and it's to the top of the flagpole.
Yeah, well, mm-hmm. You must have been giving them water.
Yeah, they get a little water. My wife has a butterfly garden there. So.
Oh.
Well, it's a nice crop for this area. It's perennial, right? And it's, mm-hmm. I think there was a time when Wisconsin grew a lot of hops.
Yeah,
I think what happened was that, you know, we don't get the dry.
Yeah.
Sometimes we don't get dry enough falls,
right.
so the industry sort of shifted to Oregon. But
true.
But I think that
it's coming
Wisconsin,
back. Yeah. It's coming back.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a couple of hops companies. Gorst Valley Hops is one, mm-hmm, and there's another one or two that are doing quite well with helping farmers to grow hops. Mm-hmm. The companies, Gorst Valley, you know, they actually give advice and they provide these everything for the farmers to grow.
You know, I bet the hops are going to have, they're going to be intensely flavored this year because of the high temperatures and lack of moisture.
Good point, yeah.
So they're going to be an unusually high quality hop. It's going to be a hop and hop season.
And, you know, Eric, go to Gorst Valley Hops on their website, G-O-R-S-T, Gorst Valley Hops, and you'll find out some more about growing hops right there. And guys, thank you so much. We'll do this sooner rather than later. Really appreciate you being with us today.
Thanks for having us, Larry.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
The Vicars of Vegetables, Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman, professors of horticulture at UW-Madison, will be back and we'll do it again with them. Thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.